It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced a new directive to bar immigrant families lacking permanent legal status from accessing federally funded programs, including Head Start. Head Start provides free childcare, preschool, and various other services to over 13,000 Wisconsin children from low-income families each year. The Wisconsin Head Start Association is among a group of organizations represented in a lawsuit against the Trump administration challenging this and other changes the federal government has made to the program. And more recently, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has signed onto a separate Head Start lawsuit against the Trump administration involving a coalition of 20 attorneys general around the country. We're checking in on how Head Start programs in the state have been affected as they navigate these changes. April Mullins-Datko is Head Start Director for ADVOCAP. That's a social service agency serving Fond du Lac, Winnebago, and Green Lake counties. April, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Jenny Maurer is here, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association. Jenny, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Jenny, your association joined up with Head Start associations of Washington State, Illinois, Pennsylvania, some parent groups to bring the suit. What is the status of the ACLU lawsuit that your organization is a part of, considering the latest directive out of the Trump administration on Head Start?
Yeah, great question. So it was just filed this week, and we're waiting for a response. And we're really hopeful that we'll see some relief that will really help protect kids and families and will really help to allow Head Start programs to keep serving kids and families and allow programs just to keep doing the great work that they're doing across our state.
And so the Health and Human Services Department issues this directive that reinterprets a law to expand the definition of federal public benefit. What does that mean for Head Start under this new interpretation of the law?
So I think part of the lawsuit is that it's incredibly confusing about what it means for programs. The law is incredibly vague. Right now, Head Start programs are not required to check immigration status. And the rule is incredibly vague, and it's unclear exactly how programs would do this. So much of what Head Start does is about creating a safe and welcoming place for kids and families. And while Head Start programs are really compliance driven and focused on quality, this rule, again, is confusing, and it's unclear how it would be implemented. It adds a layer of fear and mistrust if programs would have to be asking about these really sensitive family dynamics. And it's just really unclear how programs would add this additional piece to their mix.
April, do you know how much of the population you serve are undocumented families and what kind of impact this directive could have in your area?
So I don't have any hard statistics about that because we're not required to check that. We gather other sensitive family data about income and family makeup and size and housing status. Like all the, we gather lots of sensitive data, but that's just not a point. That's not one that is one that we've been trained or have been told how to implement with our families and in our programs.
Do you think, April, that this directive could have a chilling effect on Head Start attendance?
There is no question that it is having a chilling effect on our attendance. When just ruminations of this were coming out in the spring, we noted that we had some families of Latino descent who were not attending the program, and we had to continually reach out and just let them know that, hey, we're here to support you. We're not going to can't give access to your kid to anyone who is not that you've not given us permission to do so with, so that just letting them know that we're safe, that you don't have to worry about someone accessing your child illegally in one of our centers.
So, Jenny, if Head Start programs aren't tracking this type of demographic information, what would stop local programs from continuing to serve their communities as normal?
What would stop them?
If you can't, if you can't, if you're not tracking this type of information, could you not just keep business going, programs continuing to serve the community as usual?
Yeah, so I think the guidance that we've, as an association, given to programs right now is to pause and take a moment to give all of the authorities the time to interpret this guidance, to wait for our legal counsel to work this through the courts, and to not jump to conclusions, because what we don't want to do is create fear and chaos amongst our communities. Kate, what we know about Head Start is that the majority of Head Start families are working families, and we don't want to sow fear and chaos and mistrust with our families. And so what we have said to our programs when this came out recently was, we know this is scary, but hold on. Don't make any big changes. And exactly as you said, Kate, keep serving kids and families, and we're going to find out more. And that's part of why we worked very quickly with the ACLU to amend our previous complaint to say, we have to figure this out. This is incredibly confusing. It's totally unclear how we would even implement it. And we believe implementing it is in direct contradiction with the Head Start Act. And so we really wanted programs to not make any rushes to judgment. One of the features of the Head Start Act and performance standards is that programs do not have to, if a family is already enrolled, they don't have to take steps to redetermine eligibility. So really just to pause and not do anything dramatic in the moment, and wait until we can get more information about this, and to really be communicating and doing all the great things that Head Start programs are already doing with kids and families, which is creating that welcoming and positive environment that allows kids to thrive and allows parents to get to work in our communities across Wisconsin.
And just to be clear, you haven't received implementation guidance, from Health and Human Services or any part of the federal government?
No, there has not been any implementation details that have been released in addition to the rule. No.
We are talking about how federal changes are impacting Head Start programs in Wisconsin. We have the head of the Wisconsin Head Start Association Executive Director, Jenny Maurer, and AdvoCAP's Head Start Director, April Mullins-Datko. Congress's nonpartisan government accountability office released a report yesterday concluding that the Trump administration illegally withheld funding from the Head Start program in the first months of President Trump's term. Jenny, what is your reaction to that finding from a government watchdog?
I think it's really just a confirmation of what I know programs experienced. AdvoCAP, in fact, was one of the programs that experienced an extended delay where programs really the program the that grantees had to use to access their funding that they had already been obligated by the federal government, they were totally cut off from accessing that system. So imagine if you went to your bank and they said, you can't access your funds. That's effectively what happened to all of the grantees in Wisconsin. And over the course of several weeks and into months, programs were not able to access their previously obligated funds for things like payroll, mortgage, rent. And there was no communication, no explanation from the federal government about why this was happening. And it gradually got better, but it really sowed chaos. And what that GAO report is saying is that's not okay. This isn't how the federal government should be operating. There's a certain way that things should work when we're dealing with grantees. And it's so I think it's just really a validation that that wasn't appropriate. It's illegal. It was an impoundment by the federal government. And this can't be the way that the government interacts with our communities.
April, you felt that firsthand. Can you talk about what it felt like in those months and what you are hoping to happen here in the future for your Head Start programs?
When it initially happened, it was there was just a lot of concern because Head Start programs, we function for as reimbursement on a reimbursement basis. So we have to, incur a month of expense before we can get reimbursed for that. So we were already in need of our reimbursement for that month, and we couldn't access the payment management system. So it was just very chaotic. And luckily, I have a very, very supportive board of directors, and our executive director, Tanya Marco, very committed to our program. And we were functioning on a line of credit. We knew we had a little bit of time, before we would have to shut the doors. So we just really, really advocated hard for the release of those funds, and it took some time, but we were eventually reimbursed, and now we're kind of on a more predictable schedule. Like, they're taking longer than they used to, but we know it's going to take a little bit longer, so we kind of plan that into our
Your
to
monthly.
our request.
Jenny and April, thank you for this update on the situation. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for your coverage.
Thanks for having us.
That is Jenny Maurer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Head Start Association, and April Mullins-Datko, Head Start Director for AdvoCAP in Fond du Lac. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the beloved Little House series brought us closer to the perils of surviving weather in the 1800s. A new book digs into the science of these blizzards, droughts, and prairie fires.
When you combine the weather data with stories like Laura Ingalls Wilder's, you get the sound and the feel of what that weather was like.
The author of Wild Weather, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Little House series by Laura Ingalls Wilder brought generations of young readers closer to what it feels like to survive blizzards and prairie fires, tornadoes and grasshoppers, floods and droughts. A new book digs into the science behind Wilder's vivid and sometimes harrowing weather tales. Here's her description of spring coming to the big woods of Wisconsin in the late 1860s.
When Mary and Laura pressed their noses against the cold window pane, they could see the drip of water from the eaves and the bare branches of the trees. The snow did not glitter. It looked soft and tired.
Later in that chapter, Pa, Charles Ingalls, explains to Laura about sugar snow and getting the sap to flow in what he refers to as the maple woods.
You see, this little cold spell in the snow will hold back the leafing of the trees, and that makes a longer run of sap. When there's a long run of sap, it means that Grandpa can make enough sugar to last all year for common every day.
Meteorologist and climatologist Barbara Bousted is a Wilder scholar who has been writing about the weather in Little House books for decades. Her new book is called Wilder Weather, What Laura Ingalls Wilder Teaches Us About the Weather, Climate, and Protecting What We Cherish. Barb, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You write that in Laura Ingalls Wilder's books that weather isn't just part of the scenery, it's a character unto itself, and it's an antagonistic one. What makes weather so prominent in the Little House series?
I believe that as Laura was growing up and her family was moving around, they were so vulnerable to the weather conditions around them and to the climatology around them that they became more tuned to observe and pay attention to what was happening in their air and water and landscape. And then I think as Laura grew, because she had paid such close attention, those weather stories, the weather information was really imprinted in her memory.
Why did she pay such close attention? Because she goes through some harrowing, extreme weather calamities.
She really does. And those shaped her life significantly as a child. And, you know, much like you or I, Kate, when you think back on things from your childhood, you remember some of the big extremes, either highs or lows. And in Laura's case, things like the grasshopper infestation and the long winter and its blizzards imprinted her negatively, but those lasting marks stayed fresh in her memory. And likely as she retold those stories a few times to her friends, she sharpened her memory of the details of those events.
And this piques your interest as a meteorologist because you're putting this data-driven documentation from the 1800s and layering that on her observations. And what do you find out from that?
When we have our weather observations, our record of the past, that gives us what I would say is a skeleton, like you're digging up dinosaur bones. And with those bones, you can see the shape of the dinosaur. You can pretty much tell if it ate meat or plants, maybe a little bit about how it lived. But you don't know what color it was or what sounds it made or what its skin texture felt like. I think when you combine the weather data with stories like Laura Ingalls Wilder's, you add that depth of information, that flesh to the bones, if you will. So you do get the sound and the feel of what that weather was like, not just the data, but what it was like to really experience it in that time and place.
I think one of the moments that stands out to me is Laura suffers from the abrasions of blizzard snow on her face and wiping away her eyes and finding blood on her hands. That to me is a moment and a description that you just wouldn't find in weather data, of course.
I think that her memory of that occurring is so sharp and distinct that it really puts an exclamation point onto the dangers of blizzards, that it's not just about not being able to see well and, you know, roads being obstructed, that it can actually do physical harm to us.
So Laura Ingalls Wilder is born in Wisconsin, writes about her family's time near Pepin and Little House in the Big Woods. What were some of her observations of the changing landscapes in Wisconsin?
Laura was fairly young when she was in the Big Woods. She lived there twice, once as a baby to young toddler age, and then again around the age, you know, 3 to 4 or so. And with her memories, she does have some recollections of things like maple syrup making during her childhood with her grandparents. And I think she reflected on that as an adult, not so much in what it was like to make syrup and have a dance because there was a sugar snow that made the maple syrup run longer, but that the landscapes were changing. People were cutting down the trees and things looked different. She wrote about it in her adult years in an article in the Missouri Ruralist, which was a paper in which she had a column, where she reflected on the Great Woods of Wisconsin and how they were changing. And those changes had an impact on what it was like to live in Wisconsin, which for her time, I think, was quite a bit ahead of itself, that she was paying that close of attention to how people were shaping landscapes, changing them, and thus changing really everything about living in those areas.
And you can really then trace it all the way back to the 1860s and 70s and when Laura Ingalls Wilder is sharing these stories of her youth. How accurate are they to the timeline of what is actually happening on those days in the 1870s?
You know, for as far back as she was remembering when she wrote those books, she did a really good job. There are a couple things to keep in mind. One is that she was, you know, 60, 70 years old when she was writing these recollections of her childhood. And the other is that they are historical fiction. So while they feel very realistic and we know they are rooted very deeply in the actual events of her childhood, there are artistic choices, there are narrative choices that she intentionally took to move her story along as opposed to reflecting the exact precision of facts as she could remember them. But that said, in most parts of the book where weather is prominent, her recollection of things is pretty accurate, or at least close enough that we could look at the conditions and say, you know what, something like this probably did happen during her childhood. And a good example of that from the Big Woods is her recollection of this sugar snow, a late spring snowfall that prolonged the sap run by cooling things down at night, even as temperatures were able to rise above freezing during the day. And I can go into the weather records, and this is recounted in the book, to find a later spring snowfall that came after a milder period was followed by a milder period. And identify that to say, I can't promise that the sugar snow happened exactly as she described, but it sure could have in those conditions. And if so, we can identify the dates where it most likely did happen and where if they did have a big dance at Grandma and Grandpa's house to celebrate the maple syrup run, it would have been on, you know, a most likely set of days there that stood out in the weather records.
Your mother put the Little House series into your hands and says, read this. I think you'll like it. I mean, did these books in your childhood kind of give you a taste of the weather bug, if you will?
I think I had the weather bug and the Laura Ingalls Wilder bug both bite me at about the same time. I was pretty young when I told my mother that I wanted to be a meteorologist when I grew up. And it was around that same age where she first handed the Little House on the Prairie book to me and said, I think you'll like it. And I wrinkled up my little nose and said, I don't know. And she said, just give it a try. Those interests for me grew up at the same time. I grew up as a kid who was afraid of weather. And by learning about it, I was able to overcome fear and turn it into curiosity. And that's the passion that my family fed as they took me to the library and got me books on the weather and helped me explore weather safety and weather preparedness and just what weather is and how it's made.
We're talking with meteorologist and climatologist Barb Bousted about her new book. It's called Wilder Weather, What Laura Ingalls Wilder Teaches Us About the Weather, Climate, and Protecting What We Cherish. When you write about the hard winter and you do your research, you start your research for the book with a question, was the hard winter as bad as Wilder said it was? How did you go about looking into what this family endured in the hard winter?
This question of the hard winter was what sparked my first curiosity to really research the weather in the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, because I wanted to know if it really happened like she described, or if this was an exaggerated recollection or something she, you know, really made sound bad to it, to further the narrative she wanted to tell a story. And so the first challenge really was, is there even data available in that place and time? This is 1880 in Dakota Territory. It's not even a state yet. And European descended settlers had really just begun to arrive in that region in the few years prior. There were very sparse weather observations being taken. Some of the bigger towns around the region had routine weather observations like Minneapolis and Des Moines and Omaha. But getting a little closer to Desmet, South Dakota, required a little deeper digging. So What I found were weather records from old frontier forts during those days of early colonizing and settlement. And those weather records helped fill in some of the gaps on weather conditions a little closer to where Laura had been living. These are historical weather data. They're not, you know, they weren't observations taken in exactly the same way that we take them now, but they were enough information to help put the story together. And then another place that I looked to for other accounts and verification was other storytellers, other people who were writing newspaper articles, for instance, or telling town histories or keeping their own journals, and looking for those stories in other places too. And the more you can get those stories and observations to come together to create a similar picture, the more confidence you have in the picture that they are painting together.
As you do this research and the years unfold, you have these questions about the hard winter that leads you to co-create the Accumulated Winter Season Severity Index, or you call it AWSSI. What went into creating this index? And, you know, it's been called the Winter Misery Index.
Oh, yeah. So this is a great collaboration between myself and my collaborator, Steve Hilberg, who is retired from the Midwest Regional Climate Center and University of Illinois. And he is a weather nut, a weather enthusiast. I wanted to trace how severe the winter of 1880 to 1881 was compared to more modern winters. So we had slightly different motivations, but wanted to solve the same scientific question. How can we scale the severity of a winter in a way that we can compare from year to year and say which winter was more severe or more mild? And in deference to Steve, I try not to use the words worse or better when it comes to winter conditions. What some people really love it. Some people make their money off of winter conditions. So I try not to make judgments on bad or good. And through our calculations, we worked together for a couple of years, and this was a part of my doctoral dissertation at the University of Nebraska to solve this question. And he and I created an index based on daily temperatures and snowfall and snow depth to basically give every day a score, like it's a sport or a game, and then accumulate that score all the way through the winter. So the higher a score is, the more cold and or snowy a winter was, and thus the higher impact it had. So we used that index to look back at the long winter and determine that in a good part of the north central U.S., it was definitely in the highest category of the AWSSI, the extreme category. And in some locations, it was the most extreme record.
And taking that index to recent years, we've had a polar vortex, you know, in 2013, 2014, some severe winters on record. So in our warming climate, how is it possible to still have record or near record extreme winters like this?
In a climate like Wisconsin's, where it does get cold during the winter, we are going to still get those fluctuations towards severe conditions. What we might see is that they would happen less often, for instance. So what used to be a once a decade type of winter is now a once per generation kind of winter. And in the future might be a once per 50 years kind of winter. We're still going to get the extreme cold events now and then, just by the fluctuations of weather and the chaotic system that it is and the way that our waves can set up. But how often they happen, that part might change.
As people experience these extreme weather events, you know, you talk about being part of the weather narrative and how Laura Ingalls Wilder touched generations of readers. And part of that gift is really paying attention to how the world around you is changing. Can you talk about how we should be part of this weather narrative and tell stories of weather events in our past?
I think that, like Laura, we can be a part of keeping the record of what happened. And there are ways to do that a little more formally and by the numbers, where you can become an observer for the COCO-RAS precipitation network, submit a daily precipitation total, and that goes into the database just the same as all the other data we collect, but it's done in your own backyard. So you become a backyard observer, needing only a particular rain gauge to join this network. You can also be a person who documents and observes plants and animals and their seasonal behaviors. So when certain species of bird return on migration, for instance, or when certain species of trees or flowers emerge in spring. One source to do that through is the National Phenology Network, where you can collect those observations. And also, people can just keep those stories themselves. When a bad storm hits, or, you know, a nasty winter, or a not so nasty winter, a very mild one, to take a few minutes to write that down, you know, write a little journal entry or a blog or a Facebook post or whatever means you have that you like to write in. And those stories become part of the collective too, and help fill out that data to really tell the story of what it's like to experience it. These are things we can still do now, can continue to do in the future, and I think are important to do so that when our next generation looks back, they have some reflections on what the weather was like in our time, because almost certainly it's going to be different for them. And so the weather of the past will be something they have to study with past stories.
Barb, thank you for your book, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to the folks in Wisconsin. They are a great group that's tuned to weather and climate around them.
That is meteorologist and climatologist Barb Bousted. Her new book is Wilder Weather, What Laura Ingalls Wilder Teaches Us About the Weather, Climate, and Protecting What We Cherish. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, Beloit College's pirate mascot from the 70s has sailed into the sunset. Hear how the college designed its new Buccaneer.
So seeing a new athletic logo that's contemporary in its art design and really focused on the athletes of today is really exciting.
Mascot makeovers, that's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Throughout its history, Beloit College has been represented by a variety of mascots and nicknames, with the Buccaneer arriving on the scene in 1949. Now, athletics teams at this liberal arts college on the southern border of Wisconsin have a new logo to rally around. For the first time since the late 1970s, Beloit College has sent its rakish, swashbuckling pirate into the sunset. The old logo depicted a winking pirate wearing a plumed hat with a dagger in his teeth. The new pirate features a smirking skull wearing the tricorn pirate hat, a bandana, and a turtle shell earring. Aha! More on that in a moment. So what does it take to overhaul your school mascot? Karen Shadeen guided the process of the logo overhaul as Beloit College's Vice President of Enrollment, Marketing, and Athletics, and joins us now. Karen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've described that this new logo evokes Beloit traits like courage and adventurousness. What do you see when you look at the new logo design?
Well, you know, looking at the new logo's design, I'd be remiss in not saying it's the first new logo design since the 70s. So it's been nearly 50 years of what we're now affectionately referring to as the vintage Buccaneer. And so seeing a new athletic logo that's contemporary in its art design and really focused on the athletes of today is really exciting to me.
Can you talk about the process of changing the logo now compared to like the late 70s when the athletic director just kind of picked a piece of art out of a catalog and that was that?
Yeah, it's so funny because that's exactly what happened and probably what very many did back in the day, I suppose. The process was interesting. There have been other periods of time for the college when there was discussion about changing it, but not execution. So we knew we had an opportunity. We had the time. I suppose I decided I had the intestinal fortitude to be willing to withstand whatever the result was after the fact, because you always know there'll be people who love it, people who really don't have an opinion, and plenty of people who really object to change. So part of the process was making sure that we had a company that we felt really good about working with. And we picked Chutzpah, who's out of California, sisters who have this small boutique company. But small boutique company aside, they work with some really big clients. So they've worked with Disney, Netflix, professional teams like Kansas City Chiefs and the Lakers. So we felt like we were in good hands.
So the college's official mascot is the Buccaneer, but the campus also has this really strong affinity with turtles. Can you talk about that inspiration and where that comes from?
The Buccaneers was voted on by students back in 1949. They were at a basketball game and there was a vote to choose a mascot for the institution. And there were many options, but Buccaneers sort of came out of nowhere. And that was how it came to be. So since 1949, we've been the Buccaneers. And you mentioned the turtle. And what's interesting about the turtle is there's strong affinity with a population of students who've come through Beloit over the years around turtles. Now, we have burial mounds, ancient burial mounds on the campus of Beloit in Wisconsin, and they sort of look like turtle backs. There's also Turtle Creek and some other references. So exactly how the turtle affinity on campus came to be, I'm not sure I'll exactly know that history, but it is fondly considered. And for a long time, the students who didn't see themselves as Buccaneers perhaps saw themselves as turtles, but not all. Hmm. So it was important to us to as we move forward, 2025 and beyond, to say, how do we invite the turtle population or affinity into the new Buccaneer design, as well as have all our students see themselves as Buccaneers? So if you notice in our new logo, the Buccaneer is wearing an earring.
Yes.
And the earring is a nod to the turtle. It's sort of the, if you know, you know, that it's drawn to look like a turtle shell. And if you have no connection to the institution or turtles or knowing anything about it, you'd probably just see a gem.
Did your committee come up with that idea, or did that come from the design company?
We asked the designers for some sort of Easter egg to make it a component of the design so that the students who aren't athletes or never saw themselves as sort of belonging to that part of the institution would feel welcome and as if they belong.
How has the logo been received so far? I mean, it's early on. What have you been hearing from the campus community?
You know, so far on campus, it's by and large been very supportive. We rolled this out in pieces over a period of months, really before the public ever saw it. And, you know, we talked about why we did it, what we were looking to gain from the process, and inclusion for everyone really was part of the process. And goals for it really were that our athletes in particular, whether they're male or female, women or men, would see themselves in the new logo. And we were looking for something that embraced everyone, that perhaps it lacks gender or ethnicity or identity, really, in that we all have a skeleton underneath it all. We're all the same. And so that was really a big objective for us. And as we tell that story and reveal it on campus, and it was exciting to see people be excited about something new. But what's interesting is, and I don't know if this has been noticed, but we added a fourth color, which might seem really insignificant, but it's a light blue of sorts. And the college community has been as excited about adding a color as anything else.
did that surprise you?
It really did. I couldn't, you know, I know that the teams like to have an alternate jersey for certain events and opportunities. That's been a trend over a period of time now. And by adding something in, they're able to do that. And people like to buy merchandise, as you know, and have options. So we went with, however one describes it, it's like a Carolina blue. Nike, I believe, calls it Valor blue, but it's striking and people are enjoying it.
Okay, so then how do you go about, you know, replacing all those logos out there in local land and all the merchandise and then all the stuff around campus? What is that like?
No, that is quite an expensive proposition, isn't it? You know, so the banners that hang in Flood Arena inside the Sports Center won't change. They have the vintage Buccaneer on them, and they will stay as such. Any new ones we produce will be produced with the new Buccaneer. Signs around campus and on our fields, any place where we can finish taking care of that this summer, we will. And some places will take a little longer, you know, places that it's perhaps painted on walls and we need to order new wall graphics. So we're doing it in pieces. I don't think you'll see a universal complete upgrade all at once.
Karen, thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is Karen Shadeen, Vice President of Enrollment, Marketing, and Athletics at Beloit College. We've been talking about the new logo design for the Beloit Buccaneers. Now, what goes into designing a logo that will capture the eye, that will tell a story and connect with fans? Companies and artists work on countless logos for various brands and organizations all over the world, including here in Wisconsin. Scott Starr is founder of RevPop. That's a creative agency in Milwaukee. Scott, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
So in the late 70s, Beloit picks a winking pirate logo out of an art catalog. From an industry perspective, how has logo design changed over the decades?
Wow. So I had a deep dive into what Beloit did to see, you know, where they're going. And I have a little experience with sports identities, more recently working with the Brewers and their minor league team that we branded recently. You know, it hasn't changed much. I think it's the tools that have changed, right? And the accessibility for those, you know, that might be just starting out making logos, or maybe you're not a designer and you're able to open up a program on your computer and just kind of whip up some type. And even now with AI, you know, you can just ask ChatGPT to make you a logo. And I think it's become easier to get from point A to Z, but I think the process and the ideation of storytelling, you know, visual storytelling hasn't changed much. But I think the process has gotten easier, right? I think that, you know, the difference is being there are a lot more designers out there that make logos. I think that there is a heavy distinction between branding and brand identity that some folks don't quite understand.
What's the difference?
Differences.
Yeah.
It's a weird topic because we still say branding a lot just because most people identify with branding as logo design. And logo design itself almost devalues what branding is. So, you know, generally speaking, not that we don't take on logo projects per se, but we're very much more into branding projects where you're thinking about the story and you're asking the questions and you're diving into the mission and the vision.
Yeah. And, you know, you've worked with big brands like BMW or Snickers or locally the Brewers. Is there a difference between national or international branding versus local work that might be much closer to home?
More people, right? So I think that the reason I got out of, my work in the larger agency this is 20 years ago when I was working for a large agency in Chicago. And I think that working with brands like Snickers, working with M&M's, BMW, Lexus, there are more hands in the bucket. There are more folks that are touching things, passing things around. The creative spark tends to get lost. Things tend to turn out to be either vanilla or a remake of something that's already been done in the past because it was considered successful, and or the stats show that going down this path leads to something less risky. I think when you're working on a low, and you know, the reason why I started RevPop and came back to Milwaukee in 2006, there was an opportunity to work with restaurants, smaller companies, startups. We didn't have very many small design agencies back then. And it was a big fish in a small pond kind of thing, where I was able to take that big agency idea and bring it down into a smaller area where I could work one-on-one with owners and do what I was doing for large agencies, but bring it down to small business and handle everything from logos to websites, photo, video, everything kind of one-stop shop. And when you're working with a sole ownership, you're working with somebody with passion, with somebody that's got a vision, or, you know, they're more likely to trust you rather than take it and pass the baton and have a whole lot of people touching one thing. And then it becomes vanilla and convoluted. The story gets lost in muddied waters, right? So I think the difference for me is how working with a smaller group of people with a vision rather than a bigger brand that has either way too much behind it, way too many people working behind it, a lot more risk involved, people less likely to take risks. So I think that's what drew me to working, I think, more on a local platform.
So Scott's hot take here, favorite logo and why?
You know what? I mean, I think, and I'm not saying this because, it's a client, but I had that aha moment maybe like 6-7 years ago when I looked at the Brewers logo and I saw the MB. And that was, wearing a Brewers hat when I was a kid, and then realizing that there was an M and a B in the glove was, that was the pivotal, like, wow, okay. That just took me to a whole new level. So I think that's like, one of those identities that, you strive for is to create something that's memorable, simple. However, there's something behind it that might not be obvious or on the nose that tells a little bit of the story without, you know, being blatant or in your face.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
For sure. Loved it. And thank you for having me.
Scott Starr is founder of the creative agency RevPop in Milwaukee. We've been talking about the art and science of logo design. And earlier we heard from Beloit College Vice President Karen Shadeen about the school's new athletic logo after over 45 years of a winking pirate with a dagger in its mouth. The Buccaneers have a new pirate on the scene. Sauk City native and country music artist Dan Lapine has a debut album that is a tribute to honky-tonk country music, and he's honoring the tradition of artists like Merle Haggard. And Dan will be on the show tomorrow. We'll sample his new music. And as we talk about country music, have you been out to festivals like Country Jam in Eau Claire, Hoofbeat in Cadott, or Country Thunder in Twin Lakes? Tell us about your music festival experiences, whether it's country or another genre. We'd love to incorporate your story about music festivals in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch with us at any time. The number is 888-642-0232.
That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Rochelle Wilson, and Royce Padeswa. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.